Samsung's lawyers also argue Apple stole the iPhone design from Sony. This is the first legal battle in the U.S. between the two companies after similar battles in Europe. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
Seven people are dead in Arizona after a tractor-trailer crossed the median strip and hit a van head-on. Carrick Cook is with the Arizona Department of Public Safety.
It's a long, straight stretch of road that runs between Phoenix and California. And it just seems like we always have these types of crashes happen in this area.
Cook says all of the victims were in the van. The truck driver and his wife were seriously injured, but they're expected to survive. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, who believes smart listening and smart banking go together. Learn more about Ally Bank at allybank.com.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois. Blood donations decrease during the summer months, but patient need remains the same year-round. There are no substitutes for donated blood, and donation takes only 45 minutes. Blood donation, it's about life. More information is at 367-2202.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
31 million American adults live alone. People who live alone make up 28% of all U.S. households, making them more common than any other domestic unit, including the nuclear family. Our guests for this hour of Focus, sociologist Eric Kleinenberg, says that these numbers are more than just a passing fad. He says that they are evidence of one of the biggest demographic trends since the baby boom. And we'll be talking about that this morning in this hour of the show. It is the subject of Eric Kleinenberg's new book. The title is Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. It's published by the Penguin Press. Eric Kleinenberg is professor of sociology at New York University. He is editor of the journal Public Culture. He's also author of the book Heat Wave, which is about the heat wave that hit Chicago in the summer of 1995. Over 700 people died. And it was a very well-received book, won a lot of awards, and is really quite interesting to read. So you might want to take a look at that in addition to Going Solo. Professor Kleinenberg, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So I guess first we could talk a little bit about numbers here, and this will amply demonstrate just how significant a change here we're talking about. You write that in 1950, there were about 4 million Americans who lived alone. What is the number today?
Well, you said 31 million in the intro, but, you know, in the last few months, the census has released new updates. It's now 32.7 million Americans.
So we're getting close to 33 million.
Yeah, and I know I'm talking to Champaign Urbana. You know, I'm from Chicago. It's a smart group of listeners, so they're thinking, well, there are just more people in the country. That doesn't tell us much, but it's risen in proportional terms, too. In 1950, about 9% of all U.S. households were one-person households. Today, it's 28%. And if you look at cities around the country, it's even bigger. Atlanta, Denver, Minneapolis, Seattle, San Francisco, Cleveland, these are all cities where 40% or more of the households have just one person. And in Washington, D.C. and Manhattan, where I live now, it's almost one in two households. So it's just an enormous change.
Yeah. And it's also interesting that if you, again, go back to look at what the patterns were in the 50s, you looked at the geographic distribution of people, so where they were living and what their life circumstances were, why it was they were living alone. That's also a way in which there's been a big change.
So true. You know, in the 1950s, living alone was most prevalent in those big, open, sprawling western states like Alaska and Wyoming and Nevada. They were largely migrant working men on their way towards some other kind of life. Today, it's mostly an urban phenomenon, and it turns out that women are far more likely to live alone than men.
Yeah. This is really, it's quite fascinating. And again, maybe a little bit later on, we'll talk some more specifically about what's happening in other countries, because you do look at that as well. But maybe just at this point, it's worth making the point that this is not just a trend that we see in the United States. We see it in a number of other countries as well.
You know, when the book was, when I started writing the book, I was going to call it Alone in America. And I got the alone part wrong because it turns out that people who live alone aren't actually spending a lot of time being alone. Mm-hmm. They're really quite social. But I also got the in America part wrong. We are laggards when it comes to living alone. It's far more common in Europe. In the Scandinavian countries, upwards of 40% of the households are one-person households at the national level. In Stockholm, it's more than 60% of households. And it's even more common in family-centric Japan than it is in the U.S. So this is a global story.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can talk a little bit more here about the fact that in people's minds, there is a connection between living alone and being isolated. And it's interesting because, as I mentioned, you wrote this book about the Chicago heat wave, and your interest in looking at people living alone grew out of that and the disturbing finding that so many of the people who died were in fact alone.
That's how I got into this project. You know, I had written this book about the heat wave, and I got concerned that so many people died alone in Chicago that year because so many people were living alone and really aging alone, getting very vulnerable. I thought that when I branched out to look at this larger phenomenon, I would wind up writing, you know, another one of those books like Bowling Alone or The Lonely Crowd or The Fall of Public Man, you know, books that tell us that there was once a kind of golden age where we were better connected, we were in stronger communities, our relationships were more solid, but we had grown disconnected and atomized, alienated. That's really where I thought I was heading here. But when I looked at the broader trends, you know, I discovered that while it's no doubt true that there are a group of people who are aging alone and getting very vulnerable and we need to give them more attention and care, the great majority of people who live alone are in another category altogether. They tend to be younger, in fact, under 65, and the fastest rising group of solo dwellers in the last few decades has been young adults under 35. They tend to be relatively affluent. And as I said before, they're much more social than we conventionally think.
Yeah. It's interesting here because you would have to say on the one hand that as a just bit of demographic data, it should be easy to find out the number of unmarried adults in the United States. But it seems that you're also saying that social science hasn't, until this point, and maybe still not, very completely, hasn't really quite gotten a handle on what it is here we're talking about, because it seems to go beyond just that simple number of, well, how many people are not married.
You know, we live in an age of number crunchers and big data and statistics, and what's happened thus far is people have looked at this number, you know, the incredible number of Americans who are living alone, and they have then stopped thinking, I think. You just presume that means that people are more isolated. People are disconnected. You can see why they would think that. But if you talk to people who are living alone and really interview them, we interviewed more than 300 people living alone at different ages. And then also, if you look at some of the interesting social surveys that tell you how Americans spend their time interacting with each other, you know, a very different picture emerges. You know, what I've come to discover is that the story we tell ourselves so often about disconnection and the fall from this golden age is a kind of disruptive story, and it's one that blocks us from actually understanding how interesting our lives have become. I think that our independence has been made possible because we are, in fact, so interdependent. We're so connected to each other, and I gained a much deeper appreciation from that by looking beyond the numbers.
We're talking this morning in this part of Focus with Eric Kleinenberg. He is a professor of sociology at New York University. We're talking about some of what you'll find in his new book, Going Solo. The subtitle is The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. He has a website, which is erickleinenberg.com. You can follow him on Twitter. His handle is @EricKleinenberg, and we'd be very happy to have calls this morning. I do want to mention that we had planned this morning in the second hour of the show to be talking with Congressman Tim Johnson as a part of a series of conversations that we're having with candidates in the March primary. And it was looking earlier this morning that he would be busy having to take some votes in Congress and wouldn't be able to be with us. Well, now he says that he will be able to join us for the show. So I just want to say right here now, I hope that there are people who are listening, that in this second hour, the 11 o'clock hour, that's what we'll be doing. We'll be talking with Tim Johnson. Well, now we have a call here on the subject here we're talking about this morning, about going solo. And we'd be happy to have calls, questions, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have somebody here on our line number four, right here. Hello.
Yeah, David, thanks for taking my call. Very interesting subject. Your guest is, from my point of view, your guest is right on. Just speaking from personal examples, I have a number of nephews and nieces. They're late 20s, early 30s, and there's actually no, that I can sense, there's actually no sense of urgency either from the male or female perspective to get married. I think, just for myself, I've been married for 25 years. I think back in the day, you would start your life together to get started, maybe get an apartment for a house, so on and so forth. And now, if you have a very good job, I don't see this ever going back, and I don't think marriage is driven any more prosperity or a sense of safety or financial security. So I can tell you that from what you're reporting, that's exactly the case, and I don't see this ever going back to the way it was, and I'd be interested for comments. Thanks.
Okay.
You know, it's interesting. You can't understand the rise of living alone outside of the more widespread prosperity that we achieved in the second half of the 20th century. You certainly also can't understand the rise of living alone outside of the economic independence of women, because when women became economically independent, they could delay getting married, they could get out of a marriage that wasn't working for them. Throw in with that the kind of cultural changes around our attitudes about sexuality and people's control of their bodies and lives, and you enable people to live in very different ways than we did 60 years ago. Interestingly, money doesn't explain everything. For instance, in Saudi Arabia, there's a lot of money, but very few people live alone. That's, I think, a story about the lack of freedom for women, and also in some respects for men. A lot of people thought that the rates of living alone would go way down when the recession started. In fact, the reverse is true. Excuse me. Rates of living alone have gone up. There are more people living alone in the U.S. in 2012 than there were in 2008. And even young adults, you know, that kind of boomerang generation, we call them, because they are so often moving back into their parents' basements these days, that the proportion of young adults living alone went down from 12% in 2007 to just 11% now. It's a really modest decline, if you think about it, given the severity of this economic crisis. So I don't see this trend reversing. It's a part of the modern world that is here to stay.
Yeah, I think it's really a point worth making, and I know that you do, is that, and we can talk about the different groups of people who live alone, and they may be doing that for different reasons. But one thing that seems to be the case is that they're willing to pay a premium because it costs more to live alone to do it. So clearly there is something, they're making some choices here, and they see particular advantages. There's something in it. So I guess then the question would be, well, so if you ask people, well, why are you doing this? If this is indeed a matter of choice, you've chosen to live alone, what do you get out of it? What do people say?
Yeah, well, let's just say something about this choice matter first. You know, it's so strange for people I talk to hear a sociologist talking about choice, because, you know, in the intellectual division of labor in the world today, it's like the economists talk about choice and the sociologists talk about constraint. But you can't make sense of this outside of choice. And that is, even people who are widows or widowers, they've outlived their spouse, people who are divorced and didn't really want to get divorced, they too have other options about how to live. 60 years ago, or certainly 100 years ago, they would have moved back in with family members, maybe with friends. Today, nobody wants to do that, including older people. So we are paying a premium to get places of our own rather than live with roommates, rather than live with family. And we can't, we need to remember that in this conversation. What is it that it delivers for us? Why are we opting into it? Well, living alone comports with many of our modern values. It gives us freedom to do what we want to do when we want to do it. It gives us a chance to control our own lives and our space. It gives us a chance to get solitude, which is something we really need, especially in this age of hyperconnection and constant stimulation. And I think paradoxically, people who live alone find that it gives them a chance to reconnect both with themselves, because they get a chance to know themselves, but also with other people with whom they can have deeper relationships on their own terms.
You know, there it seems to be, and I'm not, you can talk to what extent this has changed, but I'm looking at the societal attitude towards living alone, and it seems that, at least in the past, we've been kind of uncomfortable with the idea of the single adult, and that there has been this tendency to see someone who lives alone as being somehow socially dysfunctional. And there's stigma attached to it. So I guess the question is, you know, to what extent is some of that stigma still there, or has a good bit of that gone away?
Some of that stigma is still there, to be sure, but let's put this in perspective. You know, in 1957, a group of psychologists at the University of Michigan did a survey of a nationally representative sample of Americans, and they asked them about their attitudes towards single and married people. 80% of the respondents in 1957 said that adults who wanted to be single were either sick, neurotic, or immoral. So, you know, our attitudes have changed quite a lot, and we should appreciate that. You know, that said, there still is a stigma around being single or living alone for certain people, especially at certain points of their lives. So, for instance, a lot of the younger women I interviewed said that it was terrific to live alone when they were in their 20s and early 30s, but once they hit 35, say, and for the next decade of their lives, people started constantly asking them, you know, do you want me to fix you up with someone? What are you going to do about having children? You know, are you freezing your eggs? Things like this, which signaled to them that they were being viewed primarily as single and not as full people.
Yeah. I guess, though, goes back to this idea that it would be a mistake to equate living alone with social isolation, because it does seem to be the case when you talk to people, it's certain they have friends. They may indeed have significant others that they have intimate relationships with. They certainly don't spend all their time sitting at home watching television or playing Scrabble or, you know, whatever. That, in fact, they do have connections. They are active. They do go out. They do see other people. So that, in fact, a lot of these people do have very full social lives. So you just shouldn't make that connection between, as I've said now probably about 10 times, between being isolated and living alone.
It's not just isolated. You know, we so often confuse living alone with being alone and also with feeling lonely. They're really different things. Even some of the best social scientists make this mistake, and we need to pull them apart. So, you know, you talked about the fact that people who live alone are social. You know, the best social surveys tell us that people who live alone are more likely than people who are married to spend time with friends and with neighbors. They're more likely to go out at night and to spend time and money in bars and cafes and restaurants. They're more likely to participate in public events. They're even more likely to volunteer in civic organizations. And if you think about it, it makes some sense. You know, marriages are social in a certain way, but marriages are also very greedy with our time. They pull us away from the collective world and into our families. And, I should tell you, my book is not the case to go solo. I'm not trying to persuade you to go home at the end of the show and break up with your boyfriend or girlfriend or leave your wife or husband. I'm married myself. I have two young children. And I understand this issue. When you're in a family, it makes enormous demands on your time and your energy. You just have less left to give to the rest of the world.
Yeah. Well, this morning in this hour, we're talking with sociologist Eric Kleinenberg. One thing I want to mention to people here who are listening is that this morning we're scheduled to do a test of the emergency alert system. That's that annoying thing that goes off to let you know that there's a tornado or bad weather in the area. We have a little device that does that. It's automatic, and it just pops it on the air, and we have no control over it, and it's a little unpredictable. So I want to tell people in a minute or two that's going to happen. Please grit your teeth, and it will only take a moment. And yes, there will be a little interruption in our conversation, but then we'll get right back to talking with Eric Kleinenberg. Let me also mention, too, I'm sorry for the confusion. It does look like we will not be talking with Congressman Johnson this morning in the second hour. We are going to see if we can get that scheduled for another time. My apologies for the on-again, on-again, off-again nature of the conversation. If you would like to call in here and you have some thoughts to offer on this subject of living alone, and you'd like to talk with our guest, Eric Kleinenberg, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you can also email us at will-talk, willtalk@illinois.edu. To what extent is this a class modulated phenomenon, or at least we have to establish the fact that that there are some distinct groups of people who live alone. For some of them, it may not be a choice, and it may indeed have to do with their the fact that they simply don't, you know, don't have the means.
Well, it is expensive to live alone, and so the great majority of people who do so, and in this country at least, and the great majority of the people we interviewed for the book are middle class or affluent. There are a lot of people, however, who are living alone in a more defensive way, very poor men who tend to live in these hotel residences, single-room occupancy dwellings, places that are really kind of on the margins of our cities. Unfortunately, there are not as many good places like that to live as there used to be, because so many of the downtown zones that have these have been gentrified and have built up new kind of fancy condos in their place. But a lot of the men who are very poor and living alone I interviewed talked about how difficult that experience could be. They, I say defensive, because they were often living alone as a way of staying away from people and places that might get them in trouble. And for them, it could be a much more isolating experience.
Yeah. We talked, or maybe you can talk a little bit more about how things break down, because there are basically three major groupings of people who live alone. There are seniors, there are middle-aged people, and then there are young people under 35, and that's where the fastest growth is for the youngest people. If you look at those people, particularly the under 30, you know, under 35s and say under 65s, and you say to them, well, you're happy right now living alone, you've made that choice, but do you think that this is going to be a lifelong thing? Do they say, well, you know, I think like maybe there will come a time when I will find the right person, and maybe I would want to partner up with somebody, and they don't think that that's something that they're going to be doing forever?
Absolutely. You know, people who live alone are generally not making a vow to do it. They are living alone for some stage of their life. And the mistake that we've made in the past is thinking of this as a kind of transitional stage that doesn't really deserve any attention, because what counts as real life is life in families. Generally, people are getting married. The overwhelming majority of Americans will get married at some point. But today we kind of cycle in and out of different arrangements. We live alone for some time, then we live together with someone. If it doesn't work out, people feel the freedom to get a place of their own and aren't staying in relationships that are really isolating. In fact, you know, many of the people who I interviewed who had been married before said that people worried about whether they were lonely now, but in their view, there was nothing more lonely than living with the wrong person.
Yeah, that's, I think that's really interesting. I think that that speaks volumes about how people feel about having a partner and what they're willing to do just to have one, and how important it is to have the absolute right one, that there are people who would say, you know, there are worse things than being alone, and the worst than being alone is being with somebody when that's just really not right.
That's absolutely right. There was a journalist a few years ago who wrote a magazine story and then a book called Marry Him, A Case for Settling, trying to persuade people that they would really be better off settling for a person they didn't really want to live with. And I can't imagine that was a very successful social movement, because people don't want to do that. And I think what that view kind of under or fails to appreciate is that people who live alone tend to live pretty rich lives. And, you know, they might want to have a partner, but they certainly aren't willing to settle for the wrong person. and give up the virtues of being on their own.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone who is listening in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Oh, hello. Yes. This is very interesting. I'm wondering if you could comment on the financial liability issue and some of the legal issues of combining a household versus living alone. And I'm wondering if that isn't affecting people as they get, you know, their livelihoods for themselves, if there's a fear of losing money by the liability of taking in someone else.
Well, I presume that what you mean is marriage as opposed to just
yes,
having...
or even cohabiting for a certain length of time.
Yeah, so I'm not a legal expert and can't say much about the laws in cohabiting, but certainly I've spoken to a lot of older people who are very reluctant to get remarried or to even move in with a partner after having lost a spouse. They are interested in intimacy and romance, but they would prefer to live apart together, you know, to have each person keep their own place, both for financial reasons and also for personal ones. They're concerned about the possibility, and this is true for women especially, they're concerned about the possibility that they would then become caregivers once again, that they would wind up giving over their lives to providing for a man who has a lot of needs. And it's so interesting to hear older women talk about their views on relationships, since so many have had experiences of spending their lives doing lots of domestic labor and care work for men.
Yes, I have experienced that with my friends. I'm 65, and also with having to take care of their families.
Absolutely. So I talked to lots of people who said, look, I spent my life as a caretaker, and I didn't want to wind up this way in the abstract. For people who lost their husband, who outlived their husbands, they obviously missed their deceased partner very much and wished that they were still around. But what they almost always said is that they were surprised that their life was as fulfilling as it has turned out to be. They thought they were going to be much more miserable than they actually are, because they found ways to live. And one thing I have to say here is that women, on average, do a much better job than men reconnecting with the social world, staying connected to each other. Women are on average better at staying close to friends and to family members and to building communities throughout their lives. Men are more likely to get isolated when they live alone. I learned that for the first time when I was writing this book about the heat wave in Chicago, because men were much less likely to age alone, but more likely to die alone.
Oh, wow. Fascinating. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. We are talking in this hour of Focus with Eric Kleinenberg. He is a sociologist. He is a professor of sociology at New York University. We're talking about his book, Going Solo, and we'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
The new HBO documentary About Face features supermodels of the past, reflecting on their careers and on aging. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Beverly Johnson, the first African-American woman to be on the cover of Vogue, and Carol Alt, who's been on over 500 covers, and director Timothy Greenfield Sanders, who's photographed everyone from Barbara Bush to porn stars. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program, so as you listen, keep in mind, we will not be taking calls.
In this hour of Focus, our guest is Eric Kleinenberg. He is professor of sociology at New York University, author of this new book that we're talking about here. The title is Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. Penguin Press is the publisher on this book. You might also want to take a look at a book that he wrote a number of years back about the big Chicago heat wave that hit in the summer of 1995. Over 700 people died as a result. And this work, the work on living alone, is directly related to that work, because as he explained in the first part of the interview, it was very worrisome that a lot of the people who died alone. And so he started to think about, well, what do you see when you look at living patterns and people living alone? And has made the argument in this book that, in fact, one of the biggest demographic trends to come along in a long time has been this growth in the numbers of American adults who live alone. I'm just curious, because there has been this big change. You talked about how in 1950, the single household, that was under 10% of all households, and now it's 28%. Was there a particular tipping point? And if you ask this question, well, what has happened to drive this? There are some particular things you can point to.
The big ones, in my view, are, you know, one I mentioned before, the rising status of women. You know, women's entry into the paid labor force is enormously significant, as is the cultural revolution in our attitudes about sex and control of our own bodies. That really changes the way that we live. There are others as well. I don't think that you can understand this outside of the kind of mass urbanization of this country and really the world. As I said before, living alone went from being primarily a kind of rural phenomenon to being one that's most prevalent in cities. And what's happened is that cities have built up these incredible booming subcultures of single people who come together to live alone. You know, so I give you those numbers about how many people are living alone in different cities. But if you drill down and look at the neighborhood level, the numbers can be 60, 70, in some cases 80% of all the households is one-person households. You think about places, I'm in Chicago this morning, you think about Lakeview or Lincoln Park or the West Loop. These are neighborhoods that are just full of single life, and it means living alone can be a social experience. I should say one other thing as well, which is the communications revolution has really made living alone a connected experience, starting with the telephone and the television. But today, in a time when we have Skype and Facebook and email and instant messaging, and not to mention just the entirety of the World Wide Web, you can be so connected to people and ideas while you're living at home that it doesn't have to be solitary.
I have an email question here, and it's a little complicated, so I'll see if I can get it across to you. But it does, I think, connect with this idea that living alone is expensive. So here the person writes, over the past few decades, we've seen household income for the lower quintiles plateau or even decrease. How much of this can be attributed to the people living alone? When we see the graphs of household income by quintile from the 70s with relatively flat lines for the bottom three and a skyrocketing top quintile, do all these single-person households make the disparities look worse than they actually are?
Well, the thing is that, so there's different questions, I think, in there.
Yeah.
First of all, we can't attribute this to the rise of living alone, to the rise of inequality.
Mm-hmm.
You see very high levels of living alone. In fact, much higher than in the U.S. In places like the Scandinavian nations, for instance, where there's much less inequality, much more equal distribution. What's interesting to me is that places that invest a lot of resources in the common good, subsidized housing, subsidized health care, subsidized home care, provide safe streets in cities, public transportation, all these things, they create conditions in which it's possible for people to feel secure enough that they can live the way they want to. And in fact, in places that are more equal, we find that living alone is more widespread.
And that's this. We talked way back at the beginning about you're talking about conditions outside of the United States and about how in some places the numbers of singletons are greater. For example, in Stockholm, in Sweden, more than half of all of the households are one-person households.
More than 60%.
More than 60%. So it's even more than that.
And the end of the book, you know, is really dedicated to this question about how we could redesign cities and communities and buildings so that they could better accommodate the reality that so many people in the modern world are living alone. People want to have domestic autonomy, but they don't want to be isolated. They don't want to be disconnected. We could do a much better job designing buildings that gave people the chance to live alone, but also to be connected or to get care. One building I write about in Stockholm provides a common kitchen area on the first floor, a really beautiful open space, as well as a large dining room. And the residents of this building, who live alone and have to be over the age of 40, but not 65, importantly, when they move in. They take turns cooking for each other. They cook collectively. They do a lot of other collective activities as well. So everyone in this building has his or her own private apartment, but they have easy access to community as well.
Yeah, very interesting. Let's go to another caller here, someone in Sydney. Line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Yeah, I had a couple of comments, questions. One, I fully understand the trend. I much prefer to live alone myself. My question is about whether the trend is sustainable. I mean, it's been mentioned that it's more expensive. The reason it's more expensive is that it's less efficient from a resource consumption perspective. And in a world with 7 billion people, soon to be 9 billion by the middle of the century, is this something that can actually be sustained?
It's an important question, and the truth is we really need to have much better research on this. I am concerned that it might not be sustainable. Remember, I'm not here to endorse this change so much to try to understand it. But then again, you know, let's make sure we get the comparison right. You know, who do we think is, you know, has a bigger carbon footprint? The four individuals who are living in relatively small apartments in pretty energy-efficient buildings within cities where they're more likely to use public transportation or to walk to work and to places where they go out and consume things, or a family of four living in a 2,500-square-foot house in a rural or suburban area with two cars and two driving commutes as well as commutes to schools. I have a hard time believing that it's definitely the people living alone. I think it's a more complicated issue than that.
Right. It is. You can see that it is possible to live more efficiently together with a group of people. Doesn't mean that you necessarily will, but it is possible. And as things get, as resources get dwindle more and more, then it seems like it may not be something we have a choice about.
Well, there are two things, I think. First of all, the environmental sustainability questions are going to be significant. But also, you know, one of the big drivers of living alone is also the welfare state, right? The fact that places like Scandinavia have so much solo living, or even the fact that there's so much solo living in the United States, is due to things like Social Security and guaranteed health care for older people. As I look around the world and see all of these governments slashing programs, you know, slashing the safety net, I think they might be putting themselves in situations where it will be impossible for people to live alone in the way that they have. And that will be very interesting. I mean, older people today in cultures throughout the world, including Japan and Sweden and England and Germany and the United States, want to live alone rather than to live with their children or with friends if they lose a spouse.
I see.
And so what's going to happen if welfare states cut back so many of the supportive programs that they now offer that people can't do that anymore?
Right. Okay, one more quick question. I'll take the answer offline. I'm just wondering how the changing nature of intimate relationships might be affecting this. I'm talking specifically about the rise of things like polyamory, and people more often have multiple romantic and intimate connections, and perhaps people find it easier to do that when they themselves are living by themselves. I'll take the answer offline. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah,
well, I mean, our attitudes about sex have changed quite a lot. Now, I'm not sure that our behavior has changed all that much. We might just be much more open and a little bit more accepting of different ways to live. In fact, if you go back to that golden age of 50 or 60 years ago, you know, you'd find plenty of infidelity. You'd find plenty of frustration and loneliness inside of coupledom, right? I mean, that's one of the things you see so powerfully in Mad Men, the idea that the golden age was probably not as golden as we sometimes think. But clearly, we live in a world where people are on their own and experimenting in all kinds of relationships. The fact that young adults are so much more likely to live alone today than they were 60 years ago is important here. I mean, consider that in 1950, only about 1% of young adults lived alone. Today, about 11% do, from 500,000 to 5 million. There's now a large part of life in which people are young and economically self-sufficient and out in the world exploring the things and our relationships have changed because of that.
Now, at the same time, though, I thought it was well, you would think that people who are unattached would have the freedom to have more relationships. That it was my understanding that these folks who lived alone, they actually have less sex than married people do.
I do go through this in the book. It's especially true for people who are divorced, who used to be married. You know, people who are married tend to have more sex than people who are single, especially, you know, after a divorce. Now, whether that is whether the amount of sex is the thing we should be paying attention to is itself a subject for debate. There are clearly some people who would rather have less sex with more people than more sex with one person, and they might be happier being single. But it is true that sexual activity among older people who live alone is not as common as some sometimes want it to be.
In this hour of Focus, our guest is Eric Kleinenberg. He's professor of sociology at New York University. We are talking about what you will find in his book, Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. The Penguin Press is the publisher, and we have maybe about six, 7 more minutes left in the show, and questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. So as a sociologist, you're a person who is interested in studying the behavior of people in groups. What does it mean that we are, to some extent, going against history here so many people choosing to live alone?
It means we have so much to learn. I mean, let's think about this. You know, until the 1950s, you could not find a single society in all of human history that sustained large numbers of people who lived alone for long periods of time. It literally didn't exist. Today, it's ubiquitous wherever people can afford to do it and have the freedom to do it. And that means that we have an enormous amount of learning to do. You know, I think about this much less as a social problem, although it can have problems that result from it. I think of it less as that, as more like a social experiment. We are involved in something that's genuinely new for our species. Now, that means that there's a lot of pressure on us as individuals to figure out how to live. There's not really a roadmap for how to live well when you're living alone. There's not a world full of advice about how to do it. In fact, we just haven't had a conversation about it that's very meaningful, because I really think that until recently, we hadn't exactly named or identified this change.
We have talked at least some about who are the people living alone, and something about their lives and something about perhaps why they have made these choices and how they feel about them. Let's at least try to spend a little time here talking about what that means, if indeed anything, that means for the places that these people live. So what are the implications for the community of the fact that we have large numbers of people who are living alone?
Well, I think they are an unappreciated source of vitality in the economy, in our cities and communities. You know, it's not just that people who live alone are more likely to go out and be socially active with friends and neighbors, not just that they're more likely to volunteer in civic organizations. They also tend to have more disposable income than married people, especially those with children. They are adding kind of vitality and dynamism to the economy. In recent years, the fastest rising group in the real estate market, the fastest rising group of home buyers, this is until the recession, were single women. They are really generating a kind of economic energy that we would be in even worse shape without. So I think that this kind of story we sometimes tell, that singles are narcissists, that they're selfish, they're not contributing to the collective, really fails to understand the ways that they contribute.
So you just touched on something I think is interesting, that the rate of home ownership for single women is greater than it is for single men. Are there other interesting gender differences here between singletons when you compare men and women?
Yeah, that issue about home ownership is surprising, right? Because men actually who live alone make more money than women who are living alone. So you would expect that men would be more likely to buy their own places. But it turns out that for women, buying a place of their own has become a cultural change. It's a culturally significant move. It marks for them that they are moving on with their lives and not waiting for Mr. Right. So they have these incentives to do it that are really different. And it's not just an economic thing. It's a cultural one as well. But what I've discovered is that women tend to be better at making and maintaining relationships throughout their lives than men. So this part of the gendered experience really does matter. They tend to be more connected when they're living alone. So, for instance, I've been giving a lot of talks in town halls and libraries about the book in the last few weeks, and often, single people will come out and a woman will stand up and say, "Hey, I've just been talking to the people sitting next to me, and we've decided to organize a women's group that's going to get together and socialize, every few weeks." And the men will, kind of slump down in their chairs, not really doing the same thing. So we live alone in different ways. One thing that will be interesting to track as the current generation of people who live alone so commonly get older is whether our new ways of socializing, for instance, through Facebook or instant messaging and email, have made men better at being connected with each other than, say, they were 50, 60 years ago. That's an open question.
Well, that's very interesting because just this morning I was chatting with a colleague, and I think essentially he made that argument. He said that for a while he wasn't involved with Facebook, but he found out as soon as he did, he was suddenly much more active because there were all these now invitations to do stuff that he wasn't getting before. And so suddenly he was looking and thinking, oh, my, look at all this stuff that I said I can do and need to do and want to do.
Look, there's the generation of older men today tended to have lived in families where the women did most of the social planning. They organized the meetings with friends and the nights out on the town. And that's probably much less true for the rising generation of men. It turns out, as you said, that the Internet and social media are terrific resources for connecting us. People who tend to use those a lot also spend more time with people face-to-face. When you have something like Meetup or Craigslist or Facebook or Foursquare, these are technologies that allow us to come together in really interesting ways.
Yeah. One other thing here, we have maybe about 2-3 minutes left that also I think is interesting, though, is I would expect that maybe some people who are married and have children and have all the struggles that are involved in taking care of all those things might look enviously at the single person and think about all the freedom that they have. But in fact, people who are single do sometimes have complaints and will actually make the argument that they do experience discrimination.
That's true. A lot of the singletons I interviewed say that when they're in their workplace, for instance, and there's work that's going to require staying at the office late or over on the weekends, their managers kind of respect the personal time of people who have families, but also expect that the single people are just readily available to pick up that extra load. That's one area of discrimination. There are others who say that, in certain cities it can be hard to get through co-op boards if you're a single person, especially if you're a single woman. There are people who are concerned that Social Security, for instance, gives married people the chance to pass on their benefits to a spouse, whereas single people can't identify someone else who will be the recipient of all the money that they put into that system over the years of their working lives. So there are legitimate concerns about discrimination here, and I think we'll have discussions about these in the future. One of the really interesting things to track this year is to what extent the presidential candidates and congressional candidates will try to target single voters. I mean, after all, about half of all American adults are unmarried this year, and about a third of them are living alone. That's an enormous number of people. If they could be organized and targeted in some way by candidates, there's a lot to gain.
Yeah. I know that you have said that what you're trying to do here is to understand and describe a demographic phenomenon, not particularly to say either that it's good or it's bad, that it is, and that it's something that's worth looking at and studying. And having said that, though, I think about going back to, we talked a little bit about Stockholm and about the fact that more than 60% of the households there were single single people. One wonders, is it possible for the number of singles to get too high?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the life expectancy is higher in those countries than it is in the United States. There's more equality. The quality of street life in cities, public culture is very high and robust. So, on what measure? There's a myth out there that the Scandinavian countries have these very high rates of suicide. Turns out not to be true. I think we need to appreciate the various different ways that people have of living their lives today. We tend to be very judgmental, even harsh, on people who don't get married, who aren't living in couples. We don't stigmatize them as much as we did in the 1950s, but we stigmatize them a little bit as well. We've learned to respect the choices of people in so many different areas of life. It seems to me like we should respect people's choices to live the way they want to here as well.
Yeah. If people would like to read more on the subject, the book to look for is Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone by our guest Eric Kleinenberg. Yeah, the book is published by the Penguin Press. Eric Kleinenberg is professor of sociology at New York University. He is on the web. You can go to his website if you'd like to find out more about him, erickleinenberg.com. He's also on Twitter. The handle is at Eric Kleinenberg. And Professor Kleinenberg, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Late-night comedy appearances have become a rite of passage for presidential candidates, thanks in part to Richard Nixon in 1968.
Sock it to me?
We talk with the laughing producer who made it happen.
So it's a two-edged sword. You've got to be very careful. Humor is dangerous.
Humor in the campaign toolbox. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
At the Chicago Board of Trade, corn futures are soaring above $8 as traders are continuing to factor in just how much damage has been done to the corn crop and look at supply-side issues. Informa Economics has got their yield down to 134 bushels an acre. The previous estimate there was 142.5. And Landsworth, a private firm that uses satellite data to determine its yield estimates, puts the national yield at 122 bushels an acre. Doan Advisory Services out of St. Louis put an estimate of Iowa's crop, which is the nation's top corn producer, at 117 bushels per acre, that after completing a crop tour last week. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. We'll begin in Kansas City, where September wheat is at 913 and a quarter, up 7 1/4. And March at 936 and a quarter is up 5 3/4. September wheat in Chicago, 911 and 3/4, up 13 3/4. March at 925 3/4, up 12 3/4. September corn, 819, up 20 1/2. December, 815, up 20.